Listener Production.
Welcome to Real Crime Interviews. I'm investigative journalist Adam Shand. Today we go back to Melbourne's gangland war and the events that led to Carl Williams' murder in Barwon Prison in 2010. My guest today is former Barwon prison guard turned inmate Ashley Langsworth. This story played out in the Supermax units of Barwon from 2004. Units like Acacia and Melaleuca were used to break the silence of hitmen and their bosses. In the end, most opened like rotten fruit falling to the ground. And it was the oppressive conditions in Barwon that influenced that change of mind. 23-hour lockdowns for weeks on end, no daylight, terrible food, and no contact visits with family. Once offered deals and an exit from this rigorous isolation, these crooks became very talkative. The media knew that Barwon was a pressure cooker, but rarely knew the detail of what went on in there. There was no sympathy for the inmates from the general public, who expect jails to be hard, dangerous places, where crooks must give up all information and their dignity or face the consequences. Prison officers get to go home every night, but they experience much of what the inmates do during their shifts, and it leaves a mark on them. As my guest discovered, the roles can quickly be reversed. Ashley was a prison officer in Barwon Jail for 15 years and witnessed disturbing and iconic events in Melbourne's criminal history. Suffering untreated trauma, Ash then found himself behind bars. But that's all behind him now, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. G'day, Ash.
G'day, Adam. How are you?
Very well, mate. That day when you went from blue to green, you're in jail, having been a prison officer. What was that like?
Well, I can remember that day vividly. I was working at Grevillea Unit, unlocking prisoners, and then I got a phone call off an operations manager to come out the front of the prison, which I did. There was a few detectives there, asked me a few questions and arrested me for the crimes I did commit.
That first night, what was, you know, the door slams behind you? What was
Well, my first experience of being locked in a cell was just after my interview with the detectives. And I had to apply for bail, which I did, but that took a few hours to get in front of the magistrate. And I was locked inside a prison cell or a holding cell. It was terrifying. To answer your question about my first night, it was an unbelievable feeling, a feeling that I'll never forget. It was a helpless feeling, realisation that, you know, I did commit crimes and hurt somebody and now I've got to go through this.
And that loss of liberty, I think people can gloss over, oh, jail's a country club and all these privileges and so on and so forth, but you know it's not. What is that loss of liberty like? Can you describe it?
Adam, the only thing I did miss was my daughter and my family. Everything else to me, I didn't miss at all. I knew what I was getting myself into when I was being sentenced because I had 16 years of prison life behind me, and the mobile phones and the Foxtel and going out at night and alcohol, and I didn't miss that one bit.
You sat in your cell that night and you sobbed.
I did. I did cry. Now, I've seen a lot of prisoners cry over the times and I thought they were a bit soft. When you get locked away and that cell door closes and it's just you in there, you can't describe the feeling, Adam. It's just terrible.
This story begins 16 years before then because I think it all leads up to that moment. Tell me, how did you become a prison officer?
I was between jobs and a friend of mine that I've known for some time with the local football club, he was a prison officer himself. He just told me to apply, so I did, and I got through. I thought, gee whiz, this could be a good career, you know, and it was great. I felt really good that I got a real job, a job that pays well, and I thought that I've got a job for life unless you stuff up, and I did have.
And you had no intention of stuffing up then?
None whatsoever.
What was your attitude to criminals and law-breaking?
Initially, you put the blue uniform on and you've got the power. And I've no drama saying that I probably abused that power initially in the first couple of years and treated prisoners with disrespect. And
give me an example of that.
Well, you've got the power. I remember you talking down to prisoners. They wear green and the prison staff wear blue and you talk down to them. It's quite easy to say no and talk to them disrespectfully, and which I did. I treated them like second-class citizens. You know, the first couple of years of my employment.
Because the jail is a place of punishment. The public expects crims to do it tough.
Yeah.
What impact does that have on the prison officers who are dealing with the inmates?
Yeah, well, going through the course, they soon tell you that the prison officers aren't here to judge or treat any prisoners in not the right manner, because we're there to maintain the good order of management of the prison and not to treat the prisoners any differently. But staff do take things into their own hands and do the wrong thing.
What kind of things?
If a prisoner did the wrong thing to a staff member, I've witnessed plenty of times where staff have gone into a cell and beat up on the prisoner, leaving them bloodied and injured.
Did you do that?
None. Not at all, Adam. I witnessed it. I got assaulted plenty of times.
Because you can't let these people get over you. As much as you may have sympathy for them, they're also cunning, desperate individuals backed into a corner. So is there a sense among the prison officers that you have to be tough?
I think back then you did. And the sense amongst the prison officers were, we're going to treat these guys, you know, pretty hard. But over the years, programs come into prisons and rehabilitation. The prisons aren't there to be punished. Their punishment is being locked up at night, not going home to their families. So during my 16 years at Barwon, they go from ruling with an iron fist to going through the programs and addressing the prisoners' offending behaviour.
Yeah, so you went to Barwon early on in your career.
I was at Barwon the entire career. 2003 I started and until my arrest in 2018.
Because 2003 was a very auspicious year, shall we say, in Melbourne. The gangland war just blew up into prominence. Yeah. Carl Williams was out there killing people. And by the end of 2003 and into 2004, Barwon was starting to receive the combatants in the war.
Yeah.
And from afar, we journalists could see the way the management units were being used in Barwon to put pressure on the inmates to see if they would cooperate with police, give information, so on and so forth. And there was it seemed to us a very well thought out process. You were seeing it up close. What was going on?
I was fortunate enough to be recruited to go into Acacia early on in my career, the first couple of months. And in that time, we had, like you said, the gangland prisoners. I lived it. I saw a lot. It was pretty intimidating at times. You see these people on TV and shooting people, and all of a sudden you're feeding them breakfast, lunch and tea, and then locking them up at night. And it was a surreal feeling. A lot of the prisoners are in that high security unit. The big names, they all treated staff with respect and they got respect back.
So for those who haven't seen a management unit, just describe what Acacia is.
Acacia in 2003, when I was there, it was a high security unit for the state. It housed the most dangerous prisoners, I suppose you could call it. It's four units within one. In unit one, you've got six cells. Unit two, you've got, for memory, 10. Unit three, you've got four and they're double cells. And unit four, you've got four there, loss of privileges cells that now have been, or back then were converted into normal accommodation. I think it houses up to 24 prisoners. So prisoners back then in unit one to unit two to unit three, they were segregated. So they couldn't have any contact with each other. And also within the units themselves, prisoners would also be confined on a segregation regime. So they couldn't have any contact with the other prisoners in that unit at times.
Because Acacia, to the old hands, was the successor to H Division in Pentridge, which was isolation units. You rarely saw anybody else. You could hear them.
Yeah.
And it was a pressure cooker that broke a lot of people. In fact, it turned a lot of people going to H Division from common thieves into murderers when they came out.
Yeah.
Was Acacia, in your view, as bad as H Division?
There was a more relaxed feeling than H Division would have been, I'd imagine. A lot more comforts. When I first got there, all they had was an exercise yard and that was it. But over time, they got televisions, pool tables, table tennis tables, treadmills, bicycles.
Sadly, a bicycle.
Sadly, an exercise bike, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, because people would write to me out of Acacia, Carl Williams, Tommy Ivanovic and others, and they would say, I can't do the time in here. It's too hard. No daylight, very little fresh air.
Yeah.
It was deliberately meant to be oppressive because, as I said before, I could see the Piranha Task Force was using Acacia and the way people were placed and who they were placed with as a means of putting pressure, because in the end, that's where the gangland war was solved, in my opinion.
Well, I look back at the time and there was a unit called the Major Offenders Unit, and that was organised in early on 2000s when the gangland wars were starting or going on. And they used to manage all these prisoners, the high security unit prisoners, and we had to report back to them each day about the prisoners' behaviour and what they got up to, going from a phone call to what they did on the in the yard to their demeanour and so forth. And the Piranha Task Force, they used to come in, I'd say, every other day to visit prisoners, and at times the process for coming into Acacia was anybody coming into Acacia had to be walked through a metal detector, wandered down with a Garrett wand, and also patted down physically. But at times, the Piranha Task Force detectives bypassed all that security, and we were told just to escort them into the visit room.
So they could have brought anything with them?
They could have. I dare say they did.
Again, there was a strategy at play.
Yeah.
So what would you suspect? Was there evidence of things getting in still?
I can't confirm that or deny that, but I would assume that they would have brought phones or listening devices in so they could record their conversations with prisoners in their attempt to try and win over a prisoner to give evidence on another prisoner, which it did happen over time. And in actual fact, the Piranha Task Force did take a number of staff out from the Acacia unit for an evening. And that was all paid for by the Piranha Task Force. And we got given a exclusive slideshow on the arrest and the surveillance on Carl Williams, which is quite interesting.
So you were kind of part of the machinery, weren't you, really? And as I say, it's fascinating to think that you got police detectives going through the security or avoiding the security, putting in listening devices, gathering evidence against their targets, while also getting information from prison officers, and then those two things to match up. So I think the inmates, I think I spoke to several, and they kind of felt that they were like mice in a wheel kind of thing, or watched all the time.
At the time, it made our job a bit difficult, because we had to deal with these prisoners on a daily basis, and you had to get up, have some sort of rapport with them. And then at times when the Piranha Task Force guys come in, they said, listen, don't tell prisoner blogs that we're here to see them, but go and get them for us. So we did. So the prisoners at the time, they said, hang on, Mr. Langsworth, you told me you don't know who's here, but you would have known that the police were here to speak to us. Don't do that again. So then it puts a relationship, professional relationship between the prisoner and back then the staff member on a knife's edge, because you've got to build up some sort of rapport with the prisoner over time, and then all of a sudden you just shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah, and because in those situations where there's any doubt, there's no doubt, if someone goes off for a secret meeting, they're assumed to be a dog, an informer.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of, in Unit 3, where Carl was and a few other guys, two guys decided to inform on Carl from Unit 3, and none of them wanted to go for a visit, because they all thought, they're going to give evidence against them. That was a difficult time.
There was such pressure. Let's call him the runner, one of Carl's hitmen. He was in contact with me from Acacia, and he was doing it very tough. Carl had not paid him for the work that he'd done killing people.
Yeah.
His mother was not being looked after. He was under incredible pressure. He'd done all kinds of things. He bronzed himself up with his own excrement. To avoid giving evidence, all these different things. Yeah. And you saw the other guy in there, who I called Goggles, who began to give evidence as well.
Yeah.
So the atmosphere in Acacia must have been poisonous.
It was toxic. The runner, as you described him, I think he was the first prison to inform on Carl. And he was, he didn't interact often with staff. He kept very private. But I remember he got taken out of a case, I think about 3 o'clock in the morning. I got to work that day and he was gone. And straight away, you know what's happened. You think you know what's happened. And
then you're hearing the whispers in the unit. Where's the runner gone? Yeah. What's he doing? Who's he talking to?
That's right. Then all of a sudden, you got to speak to Carl first thing in the morning and he's quite agitated and angry, as you'd imagine.
The tension's building all through this period.
Yeah.
You can tell. And cases are being solved. The public's going, yes, you know, this is great. And Barwon was right at the centre of it. Did you feel this was the mechanism how this war was being resolved?
Yeah. I didn't realise at the time, but on reflection, we got used as puppets by Piranha. And you were part of a wheel, as you described earlier. And I look back and I thought, gee whiz, you know, some of the stuff they did, that's the police, I didn't agree with, but I should have spoke up. But if you did speak up, you would have been kicked out and frowned upon. And
it wasn't your place.
No.
It wasn't your place at all. But on a human level, because you're starting to become closer with these inmates.
Yeah, yeah, you deal with them each day and you know their what they get up to each day and you deal with their family members. At the time, they used to have 3, 4, or 5 visits a week. Well, I don't know how because they're only allowed one, but they did. And you deal with their family members and you get to know them on a more of a personal level than, I suppose, a general type prisoner.
And you'd have met Roberta Williams?
I met Roberta a couple of times.
Everyone has that reaction.
Oh, look.
She's threatened to bash me that many times. Yeah. It's not funny.
I don't have any.
Was she similarly kind of excitable?
No, look, Roberta treated the staff well. I don't have a bad word to say about Roberta, nor would I say it. But she treated the staff with respect.
I think she understood that Carl's destiny was in the hands of staff.
Yeah.
And therefore, if she arced up, it'd go badly for Carl.
Yeah, it would make his time a bit more difficult. But back then, the supervisor of Acacia, he was very professional. He wouldn't allow anything untoward go on.
There's a saying that over time, the green starts to infect the blue. Is that true?
It possibly. I think over my 16 years, it did affect me, I believe. I suppose, what do you call it? The Stockholm Syndrome. I believe I was a victim of that. You sort of see of how management play games with the prisoners and you can see what's right and what's wrong. And the way I sort of felt is I like to stand up for what's right. And at times, management were playing games with a lot of prisoners. If they didn't like them, they wouldn't get, you know, what other prisoners would get.
And one word from a prison officer could make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
April 2010, Carl Williams is murdered.
Yeah.
Where were you on that day?
I was driving past a local pub at the time and my wife rang me up and said Carl's been killed and I said there's no way he could be killed. And sure enough, I got home and put the news on and he was dead. So I couldn't understand it at the time, but, you know, with what I know now, he should not have been mixing with Matthew Johnson that day. After reading the Herald Sun, he shouldn't have been allowed out.
Funny thing that. I mean, I'd spoken to Carl the previous weekend on the phone and I'd asked him the very question, are you okay with Matty Johnson? Because I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
I'd had that story a few weeks before, by the way.
Okay.
I'd been here at Triple M and Roberta Williams came out of doing an interview with Eddie McGuire.
Yeah.
And she said to me, you won't believe it, the cops are going to pay Dakota's school fees.
Yeah.
I said, what? And I weighed up that story long and hard and didn't write it in the end.
Yeah.
And then when I heard it was going to run, I was very concerned.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Carl and he was concerned. No, yeah. There's no doubt about that. But he wasn't concerned about Matty per se.
Mm.
Was there any evidence that he should have been, do you think?
Well, a few months later, the prison's internal investigations came and spoke to a number of people. And I was one of those people and they asked me, could it have been avoided? And I said, absolutely. I said, if I was in that unit at that time with my supervisor, that was my supervisor when I was in there years earlier. I said, we wouldn't have unlocked that door that day. We would have managed that situation up to major offenders unit or as high as we could go, because everybody knows Matthew Johnson doesn't like dogs, people that inform one other prisoners.
And I think by that time there'd been a general acceptance in the prison population that Carl was going to tell stories about everyone. That was the fear.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether Matthew Johnson was then, I guess, further freed from consequences.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, I was working in Malaluka at the time, and I just don't know. When you're not working in the unit, you don't get the feel, and you don't sort of the people within that unit keep to themselves and don't like discussing other things that happened with other people. So I don't know, Adam.
Yeah, because this is one of the great conspiracy theories that still get around, how Carl Williams was killed under all these cameras, all this security, all this stuff, and Matthew Johnson's able to take the stem off an exercise bike and brain him 8 times and kill him. No one still sees. In fact, they had to report it. Yeah. So there's a great conspiracy theory that somebody had nobbled the whole system.
Yeah.
What's the reality from inside?
The reality is the unit's very busy, and look, it should have been picked up earlier. There's cameras there, but at that time, the cameras were pretty poor. I can't believe it took, half an hour or so? Yeah, I can't understand that, but I've got no answers.
Yeah, because I guess in life, when you're faced with a conspiracy or a fuck-up, I always go for the fuck-up, right?
Yeah.
Because the human being's involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a human environment.
Yeah.
And I think it's very hard for prison officers to know what's going on if one inmate doesn't say, I'm scared of him.
Yeah, Carl, I don't believe Carl would ever say that. He was a very confident person, and I don't think he would ever put his hand up and say that, you know, I'm in fear of my life. He might have spoke to Roberta and told Roberta that. I don't know, but he was a very confident person.
Yeah, for a guy who wasn't physically prepossessing, wasn't a good fighter, I think he relied upon being a good bloke mostly and bringing people to him in this sort of hail fellow well met thing.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion of Carl, he treated me well and staff, the other fellow staff well.
Treated me well too?
Yeah. You know, what he did outside of prison, I don't know, and I suppose speculation, but it's not great. But how he treated me was respectful.
Yeah, that's right. So he's killed. Matthew Johnson goes into an isolation cell. That's where you come in.
Yeah, the following day I was working in Malaluka, the other high security unit, and I got a phone call by intelligence to get a urine collection off Matt Johnson. So I took a colleague of mine and we went to the loss of privilege area where he was housed, took him to the urine collection room and collected the urine sample. But during the – Matt doesn't talk much to staff members at all. During the collection process, he asked me for a shower. And I said, what do you want to shower for, Matt? He said, I'll never forget those words, I've got to wash all Carl's brains off me. I said, come on, Matt. I said, I don't want to hear that. And then he said, what's the problem, boss? You know, people die every day. No, I was gobsmacked. I could not believe those words had come out of his mouth.
What did that mean to you?
I was just in utter shock. I thought, what the hell, you know? So...
And you've been in the prison system for a long time by now.
Well, that would have been.
And you'd seen death in prison before, had you not?
Not death.
Suicides.
I've seen suicides, yeah, absolutely. I've seen suicides and I've seen, you know, prisoners severely injured, stabbed and bashed. But it took me by surprise that somebody could actually say that when they did the act a day earlier. So I took Matty back to... the cell, and I reported that to my day shift supervisor, and he asked me for a report, which I did. I lodged a report, and that was it. But then I got a phone call maybe couple of weeks or a month later, and I had to go into the exec room, and there was a detective there from the Victoria Police wanted me to make a statement in regard to what Matt had said during that collection process.
Yeah, and then you gave evidence in court.
Which, you know, I didn't want to.
Why not?
Well, you're a prison officer. That's your job, and you've got to deal with prisoners each day. And for an example, Adam, when Matthew Johnson got his brief of evidence by Victoria Police, it took less than 24 hours, and all the prisoners in that unit, in Malaluka unit where I was working, all turned on me. You know, I had death threats, reported it to management and...
Simply because you'd done your job and reported what had been said to you.
That's right.
They expected you to be on Johnson's side.
That's right.
Why? Why would they expect anything less
of you? I just think any chance to have a go at a staff member and to side with Matty Johnson, if they side with him, they're protected.
So you're expendable in that situation.
Yeah. So I did. I went home and I was in fear. I didn't know what was going to happen. And so I reported that to management and they said, oh, you'll be right. I got to work the next day and they, I think that's when David Prideaux spoke to me. He moved me up to Castlemaine Prison, Loddon Prison. I was up there for 2 weeks and I returned and they moved me to a management unit in Banksia Management Unit where I was confronted with another prisoner by the name of Rodney Collins.
Rodney Earl Collins.
Rodney Earl Collins,
one of the most cold-blooded killers Victoria's ever produced.
Yeah, absolutely. And the first chance he got, he called me down to he was in a caged area at the front of his cell and he called me down to that area and I could go down there by myself because I was only 3-4 metres away from the unit console. And he said, Mr. Langsworth, he goes, you give evidence against Matty? And I said, yeah, I have. He goes, you're a dead man. I said, okay, and I walked away and again, I reported that to management and nothing happened.
How'd that make you feel?
It made me feel sick in the guts, expendable. I soon realised that I was just a number. Just a number and...
Just a cog in that wheel.
They just don't care. I felt they just don't care. I was on a time off over the time, over a period of time and through work cover and through PTSD and depression. And you just get pressure by management to come back to work. You know,
I can see how difficult this is to talk about even now.
Yeah.
You've done it in court, you've done it in jail, but here you are years later, I can still see it's emotional for you. This was the start of a pretty steep decline for you.
Very steep.
What happened?
Probably the last 10 years of my career at the prison, I turned to alcohol. And I would say that I was an alcoholic. I would drink 10 to 15 beers, cans of beer each night, every night, for 10 years. Just to self-medicate and...
Did it work?
At the time, I thought, yes, this is great, you know. You go to work. I don't know how I functioned.
You had a family at the same time, a wife and a kid. Your wife wasn't a prison officer. No. Could she understand what you were going through?
Yes. Well, funny enough, she'd been inside prison back in... the early days of my career, in the Acacia days, Mr. Spadano was the general manager. He allowed my wife at the time and another colleague's wife to have a tour of Acacia. Yeah, and that was because I was a senior prison officer and my direct supervisor ran Acacia and we were allowed to bring our partners in to have a tour of where we work, which was quite amazing. I don't think that would be allowed now.
No way.
But at the time, it happened.
Probably helped a lot too.
Yeah, it did. So my wife at the time gave her some sort of understanding of where I work. And
but you did break up with your wife. Was that due to pressures in the job, do you think?
Oh, look, I think a lot
were
of
you
things.
Were drinking?
Drinking. I think a lot of things. I had a young child and I wouldn't say it was just one thing, Adam, but it was... various things.
And then you were in a relationship with a woman who was a prison officer.
Yeah.
Was that easier, do you think, if you were someone who understands what your day-to-day is?
It was easy because your partner knew exactly what was going on in your life at work and vice versa. And, you know, you get home and you understand you've had a hard day and they understand, you know, the way you are and vice versa. It was good in one aspect, but the other aspect... I wouldn't recommend it.
There were interpersonal difficulties and then it all came to a head on one night. What happened?
We did break up and I was drinking heavily, medicated heavily and I went around to her place, entered her place and I had a weapon with me, I had a knife.
A big knife.
A big knife, yeah. And we wrestled. Her boyfriend was there at the time. He just sat there.
What were you intending to do when you went there?
Adam, I don't know. I look back, I've reflected a lot, and I think I really wanted to scare her, I suppose. And I did immense behavioural change while I was incarcerated. And during that program, I wanted to say that I'm in charge. I say what's going on.
You know, as you did every day in your work life.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a scary night. That was
So you threatened her and her boyfriend. There was a tussle. She was cut by the knife.
Yeah.
You made threats to kill.
Yeah.
But in the end, what happened?
In the end, I had her by the neck or the throat area, and it with one hand, and the other hand I had the knife, and I had it in an upright position, you know. And she said, "Think of your daughter. Think of your daughter." And at that point, I released her and I took a few steps backward and sat down, and I broke down in tears. I put the knife down and I broke down in tears, and we went outside, all three of us, and sat down, and we spoke for about half an hour. I got driven home by her, and it was a terrifying act by me, and I feel so bad for her and her family, friends, for what I've put her through. I'm just
has she forgiven you?
Oh, look, I don't know, Adam. I'm not allowed to have any contact with her.
So that was reported and you were arrested?
I was arrested at work, yeah, a couple of weeks later, and yeah.
Terrible moment in front of your peers, in front of the inmates?
No, it was
the inmates aware?
Well, they would have been aware. News travels fast in prisons. I dare say they would have all known that day. Yeah, so I was on bail. I got bail, and I was on bail for 12 months. Drank extremely heavy for that next 12 months. Heavily medicated. I was on three different psych drugs at the time. Drinking copious amounts of alcohol, and still functioning. I didn't have any contact with prison staff. The only contact I had was with the HR operations manager at the time, and he spoke to me about three or four occasions, and embarrassed at the time. She decided not to represent me for some reason. So I get a phone call whilst I'm waiting for an operation in hospital. I was getting my knee operated on, and I get a phone call from this fella called Tim. He said, "Ash." I said, "Yes." He goes, "I'm Tim." I said, "G'day, Tim." And he said, "You got caught tomorrow and you're going to get locked up." I said, where's my other barrister?" He goes, "Oh, she's not representing you anymore," which I don't know why or how. Or
was the fix in? Did someone get to her, or you think? Or
I don't know why or how, but she did just bail on me. And I've heard plenty of times by prisoners in the past that this does happen. I thought, nah, there's no way that would happen.
Well, but it does.
It does. I lived it.
I come from a family of lawyers, and Trust me, it does happen. Because they have to be friendly and seemingly matey, whatever, but they're not. There's always a barrier between you and the council, which they maintain.
Yeah. When we did, when I decided to plead guilty, my barrister at the time, Lee, she said, at worst case scenario, I'll get 3 to 6 months jail.
What'd you get?
I got 3 years. Yeah.
Tough 3 years. Now we're back in that cell on that first night, and you're facing 3 years of this.
Yeah.
What was your plan?
I didn't have a plan. I did not have a plan, but I sort of felt that I would be moved to Ararat prison, where it's a protection type prison. And that was on the Thursday I arrived at MAP, and on the Saturday I was moved to Ararat. And I was moved to a unit called Oliver Unit, where as I looked after a lot of those guys whilst I was a prison officer at Barwon. And
they must have laughed.
They did.
Source of mirth. Ah, absolutely. Look at it. You've gone green, Mr. Absolutely. Blue.
Yeah, that's right. So that was pretty hard. But after a few weeks, they've moved me to a unit which is used for Korean witnesses. And there was about seven or eight other prisoners in at the time, which I knew all of them. And they were pretty taken back by me walking in there in green. But they all treated me well.
Did they ask why? They say, what are you doing outside now?
Yeah, I told them the truth. I said I stuffed up, you know, and this is what I got. And I couldn't believe I got 3 years for what I did. But I suppose on reflection, it could have been a lot worse that night. And I'm thankful that it wasn't.
Yeah. Some prisoners, they say, do time easy. How did you do it?
Look, I wouldn't say easy, but I utilised the time effectively. I got down to about a weight of 73 kilos. I was fit as.
What are you now?
99. I wouldn't want to say I'm 100, Adam, but I'm pretty close to 100. So I went in there about this weight, and I rode an exercise bike. I used to ride every day, and I rode 15,000 k's in about 12 months and walked a lot, did a lot of gardening, and I met a bloke in there from Geelong. And we got on really, really well. And it made the time easy. You know, you had somebody to talk to and confide in, and it was good. I'm not saying jail was good, but I utilised my time well.
Yeah, because you must have looked at what had happened to you, your actions, where you were, with a sense of bewilderment. How the hell did I get here?
Absolutely, I did.
But I guess over time, you get some insight into the forces, the influences that led you to that spot.
Yeah.
Was it working in Barwon? Was it working in those units in that superheated environment that led to this?
Yeah, look, I think it's a number of things, Adam. I think that PTSD, depression, alcoholism, medication, and then the betrayal as well, just a cocktail of things. And I think that, you know, I just flipped and did what I did, and it's so, I feel bad for my actions, but I believe that the support or lack of support by management at Barwon or Corrections Victoria on a bigger scale was very poor. It was very poor.
The prison psychologists talk about a lot of the men who end up in prison lacking what they call self-soothing skills to stop themselves doing these, particularly when they come out of jail, you know, and I wonder if you lacked those same skills at that time. Your dialogue with yourself was poor.
Yeah, extremely poor. You know, I had the blinkers on at big time, and that they enclosed every day. But having done a 15 months jail and then the remaining on parole, I did participate in four or five different programs, a men's behavioural change, a violence program, a drug and alcohol program. And I utilised my time well because I thought, well, I'm here, I'm going to make the most of it. And I did, and I've come out a better person. And the way I look at it, I've been given a second chance in life.
Mm.
Yep.
You're full of remorse and guilt about what happened.
Yeah.
But you're not a bad guy. Have you forgiven yourself?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Good.
I have forgiven myself. It took a long time. I couldn't believe what happened. But it did happen, and I processed it all, and I consider myself a good bloke that did something extremely bad.
On one night?
On one night, yeah. Yeah.
We can't have these things over, but we can forgive ourselves eventually. So you're only 50.
I've just turned 50, yeah.
Young, strong man.
Yes.
You know? What's the rest of your life look like?
Well, my daughter's 12. Number one priority for me is being a good father. I have her a fair bit of the time. We have a great relationship. Her mother, my ex-wife, I have a good relationship with her as well. So things are good on the family side of things. I've got a good network of people now. My brothers and sisters, my parents, and also a good family friends, Tony and Sherilyn. That's where I lived when I got released from prison. And my network is very small, but it's very good.
Big networks are always suspicious.
Yeah, that's right.
in my view.
Yeah, that's right.
Young people listening to this might be considering a career in corrections. They're thinking, not for me, this sounds horrific. But I don't think you'd do too much of it differently.
If I had my time over again, I'd do exactly the same thing. You know, it can be a good career. It can be, if the processes of looking after the staff have improved, debriefing and post-incident care, if that's improved, it could be a good career for a person of the, you know, a middle-aged person. I wouldn't recommend a young person get involved in prison life, but it can be, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, you got through it. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
Thank you for being a guest on Real Crime Interviews, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Adam.
Executive producer Grant Tothill. Mixing, editing and theme music by Matt Nikolic. Associate producer Matt Dwyer. Research by Nolly Way-Shand. Digital producer Jack Shand. This has been a Real Crime production. Written and produced by Adam Shand.
Listener.